Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Jenna Clake about her literary novel, Disturbance. Jenna is an award-winning poet, born in Staffordshire. She has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Birmingham, and she's a senior lecturer at Teesside University. In this episode, we discuss using witchcraft to write about female agency, the challenges of novel writing versus poetry, and how Jenna WhatsApps herself notes on the go to keep her ideas alive. But before all that, here's Jenna with an excerpt from Disturbance.
Waking up so often in the middle of the night meant that I recognised the sound of the walker's door clicking as Chelsea sneaked out. Through my peephole, I saw her shuffling into her trainers. The communal light switched on, so I could see Chelsea clearly, standing on her front doormat. She was in her pyjamas, a grey hoodie and a pair of light pink shorts with lace around the bottom. Something wasn't right. She was pale and had dark circles under her eyes. Her face was blotchy, as though she'd been crying or was having an allergic reaction. There was a red mark scored across one of her thighs. She appeared to be waiting for something. Then I realised. She was worried that her parents had heard her. She was listening out for any sign of movement before stealing away. Suddenly, she darted down the stairs. I moved quickly back through my flat to watch her from the window. We arrived at the same time. Chelsea landed on her knees and tore the grass and mud with her fingers, clumps in her hands like hair. She pulled the stone from the ground, and I expected her to throw it away because, I believed, with shock at my own train of thought, that it must be cursed. The thought felt inevitable, true. My instinct to run to her flared. I wanted to help, to understand what was happening. As I thought this, the centre of my palm stung, as though I were holding the stone. Chelsea took a tissue from her hoodie pocket and wrapped the stone up carefully. She cradled it in her hand like an injured bird. Two beams of white light down the road, heat rising from the tarmac. She stared at the headlights of the car, which felt so bright I had to shield my eyes. The red Fiat 500 pulled up again, and the dark-haired girl got out. She approached Chelsea carefully, as though she were contagious, and then reached for her elbow, avoiding the stone. She pulled Chelsea towards the car. They drove off, without the radio on, in silence.
Hi Jenna, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Disturbance.
Hi Chloe, thanks so much for having me. It's really great to be here.
So Jenna, can you start by telling us what Disturbance is about?
Yeah, Disturbance is about a woman that has an escaped and abusive relationship, and she starts to dabble in witchcraft with her teenage next door neighbour, Chelsea, and her best friend, Jess. And that has some disastrous consequences.
Oh, yes, a little tease there. It's always difficult in episodes not to give anything away, and we'll talk kind of thematically, and we won't try and give too much of the general story away. But I wanted to talk a little bit about your your background in writing, because your poetry has been published before and you're an award-winning poet. Had you always wanted to write novels as well, or was this a kind of a first thing for you?
So I went to study creative writing at the University of Birmingham, on the whim that I just had always wanted to be a writer, but I'd literally never written anything before. So I was like, oh, great. If I go to university, they'll teach me. And I wanted to be a novelist. I had it in my head that that's what I was going to write, because that's all I'd ever read. And then I had a wonderful tutor, the poet Luke Kennard, and he just made me fall in love with poetry. So I became a poet sort of by accident. So I'd always had it in my mind that I would write a novel, but I think I put it off because I was a bit scared. And then the pandemic happened and I was stuck alone in my flat for a very long time. And so it seemed like the perfect project to stop me from, you know, having a bit of a breakdown. It sort of gave me the structure every weekend to do something with my time, especially during that winter lockdown, which was just awful. So it sort of pushed me, I think, to do something that I'd always wanted to do.
Did you find the transition easier than you expected? Or, I mean, was it very different from writing poetry?
It was so different. I think my biggest mistake was trying to approach writing a novel like writing a poem. I did that and handed in a draft or like 20,000 words to my agent. And then he was like, yeah, great idea, terrible execution. Like, you need to go back and think about plot. This is just like a series of subplots. So I found that it basically required me to learn a whole new set of skills and practice them and figure out what I was doing. And I think writing poetry really came in on a line level. I wanted to write a very lyrical novel that used a lot of my experience of being a poet. It was a totally different experience and I learned so much from it.
Did you find it maybe more freeing to have the space of a novel, or was that kind of terrifying that you had so many more words to write?
It was terrifying to begin with, but I had found that as I was writing poems, my poems were just getting longer and longer, and I write a lot of prose poetry. So at one point someone said to me, are you sure you're not just writing short stories now? Like, they were getting so long and had really long plots and characters and things. So I think I was really like pushing at the boundaries of poems. And so I did find it more freeing, I think. And it felt like a real chance to sort of step away from myself. So I wouldn't say that my poetry is necessarily like personal confessional. It's always been character driven and sort of monologue driven and that sort of thing. But I just found I wanted to play with a bigger cast of characters. I wanted to see what I could do, and I wanted to inhabit a different world. Whereas in poetry, it often feels like you're in a world for a really short amount of time. And I wanted more space to play with that.
So the idea for this novel you had and straight away thought, this is going to be a novel, or did you work on it as a poem? Like, tell us how the idea evolved.
Yeah, so it was definitely always going to be a novel. I can't remember where I first got the idea from. It just suddenly sort of was there. And I couldn't really ignore it, but I was sort of just playing around with it for a really long time. Putting things down into a document and then like being like, okay, well, I've got this scene, but what does it mean? And then it really sort of took off when I'd got this idea of a woman who's really lonely, who's escaped this relationship. I wanted to do something with teenagers because I'm endlessly fascinated by teenagers and like And yeah, I just like I think about me and my sister growing up and how different we were, and yeah, it just feels like really rich material for me. But then I in the second lockdown, the flat above mine was a Airbnb party rental, and someone rented it out for an illegal rave, had this illegal rave, and like I just thought, right, stick my earplugs in, go to sleep, like just ignore it, whatever. And then I woke up to the sound of the police banging on my door. And in my bedroom at the time, there was a balcony next to my bed, and there were these like people moving on my balcony outside. And it by the time I'd got to my front door, they'd pulled someone out the flat next to mine and were arresting them. So I sort of stayed inside. But my neighbors came around the next day and they were like, oh yeah, so these people, we called the police on them, and they all jumped out onto your balcony. So this was like really terrifying. And like for days afterwards, I just like any movement, any noise, I was really scared. And then from that, I was like, oh wait, like this is a really scary experience. And what if the other thing happening to this woman was that she was living in a haunted flat, or she sort of believed she was living in a haunted flat. And that just seemed like a really interesting way to think about trauma and to think about what she'd been through and how that would manifest in her everyday life. So it's sort of it was like the perfect thing you want to happen to you if you're a poet. Like poets are often like looking around at the world and being like, ah, this thing like popped in front of me. So I think my poetry brain sort of kicked into gear and I was like, oh, this is really interesting, but it felt too much to try and get into a poem.
It's far too dramatic for a poem.
Yeah,
Also,
absolutely.
quite an unusual event. I mean, that doesn't exactly transpire into the novel, but obviously I guess the atmosphere and the tension is something. I mean, the novel is incredibly tense throughout. You get this horrible feeling of like dread while you're reading it. And that obviously came from that event. Tell us about your unnamed narrator. And did you specifically go out and think, I'm not going to name this narrator so that she can be everyone? What was your thinking behind that?
I think at first I just hadn't committed to a name for her. And like names feel really powerful. And so I'd got the teenage girls' names like straight away, but I couldn't stick with anything for my narrator. And then I realized part of that was that she doesn't really know who she is anymore during the novel. And the novel is sort of a journey of her trying to find herself after this really traumatic thing that's happened to her. So I wanted her to be this sort of shadowy figure, and her ex is a really shadowy figure in the novel too. So have not having her named, I think, was part of that sort of experience of her trying to figure out who she is still, and trying to grasp at other people to define her in a way, or grasp at other things to define herself. So I decided quite early on that she wouldn't be named. I think I would now always name my characters. I feel like once you've done it once, you can't just be like, oh, they're always unnamed. But it felt right for her, I think.
Did it give you extra complications not giving her a name?
Oh, absolutely. Like, bits of dialogue where or you're like, oh wait, they can't say her name, or there's certain points where like someone needs to get her attention. So I had to write something like, Eddie said my name, or whatever. And so I was like, oh, I have tied myself in knots here. But it also felt like a fun challenge to think of all the inventive ways around it. And I think writing should be about challenging yourself and trying to see what you can get away with, or what you can do, or where you can push your skills to.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's touch on the topic of domestic abuse then, because I don't want to give too much away, and I'll let you give away what you want to say, but that's a major theme in this novel, and I wondered how you went about handling it, because obviously is a topic that's incredibly sensitive and you know, I imagine very difficult to write about. So what was your experience like writing about this?
Yeah, it was really hard to write those scenes. And I suppose the best way to describe it is there's sort of a level of the novel which is explaining or exploring the narrator's experience of that relationship through like vignettes or memories, and those sort of impact how she behaves in the present of the novel. So the way I went about writing those is I wrote all of those first, because I wanted to understand her journey, and then that would help me understand what was happening to her in the present of the novel. And the way to sort of approach that is I didn't want it to be really sensationalistic. I wanted the reader to know enough about what she'd been through that her actions in the present would make sense, and that we could understand her. But I didn't want to write a novel that was solely about that relationship. I wanted to get her out of there, really. When I started writing those scenes, that what I really felt is like I wanted her out of that. So then it was, although the sort of present of the novel is quite dark, there are moments of levity and light in it. And it felt like a relief to write those. But to write those scenes of the relationship, I just went back to a couple of novels that I had felt did a really good job of expressing that experience. The first one being First Love by Gwendolyn Riley, which is just this really sort of lyrical, pared back account of a woman's relationship with her older husband. And it just sort of treads that line of understanding why someone stays in a relationship at the same time as it is bad for them. And Mina Kandasamy's When I Hit You, which is just sort of a really powerful account of domestic abuse. And I think she sort of pushes things further than I wanted to. So it was good to have those two books to sort of go between and think, well, how have they done it? What do I want my book to do a bit differently? But like, how can they teach me how I want this to come across, I suppose.
Yeah, I think I certainly think when I'm writing and there's something I'm not exactly sure how to approach or how to write it, I'm always looking at how other writers do it and how they do it well, because I think it's just helpful to kind of absorb some of that, because you think, well, they've done it so brilliantly and I want to somehow emulate that and be like their work, even if, you know, I'm not 100% as good as them or whatever your feeling is at the time. But particularly when you're dealing with topics that are really sensitive like that. Your lead character gets fixated on her teenage neighbours, as you said, and she starts to explore hexes and curses. What made you go down this route of kind of witchy elements? There's a lot of books at the moment are very witchy. You've kind of hit the right time on that front.
I know, it was perfect timing. It wasn't planned at all, but it was great. But yeah, I was obsessed as a teenager with Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Charmed, The Craft, anything sort of supernatural, witchy, I was there. And like, my family was very into TV when I was growing up, so we'd all sort of sit and watch these programs together, me and my sister especially. So it firstly came from that, just this sort of nostalgic love for something that I wanted to share. But I think why witchcraft feels so powerful and why it's possibly so popular at the moment is that I think it's a perfect sort of vehicle to think about female agency or women's agency, to think about sort of feminism and modern iterations of it. I mean, I got obsessed with witch talk while I was writing the novel. I'm terrible at TikTok, so I was just sort of lurking there. But I just think, like, it was just amazing watching how inventive young women or girls could be, and it brought me back to being younger and like playing with my friends or doing my own witchy experiments, and the sort of like power and agency that gives you, that it makes you feel like you have your own system of meaning in the world, or like you and your friends are connected in a way. And, you know, witchcraft historically has, has been a place where women are maligned and sort of persecuted and prosecuted. So I was thinking about, well, how are we thinking about witchcraft today, and how would my narrator latch on to that as a way to sort of make herself feel better? And also, how would she use that in all the wrong ways?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Yeah, definitely. What is it about the, I mean, you said you have an interest in teenagers. What about your lead character then? What is it that's so appealing for her to kind of observe the lives of others?
I think it comes from her absolute loneliness, really. She's living this really isolated life, and she sort of feels that she's lost everything. So it's a game of sort of self-flagellation, I think, in part. She sort of watches her neighbour Alice quite a lot and uses her as a way to be like, oh, that's she has everything I could have had. So she sort of uses that as a way to make herself feel bad for the past relationship and its failure, even though that's ultimately not her fault. And then I think her obsession with her next door neighbour, Chelsea, is that she sees herself in Chelsea and thinks Chelsea sees herself in her. And so she sort of is very misguided but well-intentioned, I think. And so this watching of other people is sort of living vicariously through them, but also wanting to sort of be an active participant in her life when she feels that she's not really.
So Jenna, tell us a little bit more about your kind of writing process. I mean, your poetry is, I guess, where you started, but how do you write? Are you someone that is very kind of a planning person? Are you someone who kind of, I don't know, sits and scribbles away with loads of notes before you get started? Kind of what's your general process to write? What was your general process to write this novel?
So my general process to write this novel was a process of chaos, which I ultimately regret. But I think, so when I was first writing, I did not plot at all. It was just sort of notes and idea. I was like, oh, I'll just get this idea down. Then I realized that I needed to go back and actually plot what was going to happen. Like, you can't handle that many people and you know, that much, that many words and not have a sense where you're going. So I'm quite a visual person, so I would like draw myself little plotting plans and things. And then to write the novel, I'm someone that gets really bad existential dread about my writing while it's happening. So I've learned that the best way to deal with that is do like short, sharp bursts of writing. So my maximum sort of time to write is about 3 hours. So I really envy people that are like, oh, I've got a whole day to write and I'll just sit there and write. Like, I wish I was that person, but I am not. But I find if I can get something down, then I feel pleased with myself. And I think, yes, that has done something today. Well done. Whereas if I spend a whole day with it, I go from feeling good to feeling bad at like sort of past lunchtime. So that like by 5 o'clock, I think, what am I doing with my life? Why do I write? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Throw the laptop out the window. So that works really well for me, this sort of short, sharp thing. And I also really like walking as a way to write. So I have a WhatsApp group that's just got me in it. So I can like text myself and voice note myself. And I will just go for a walk if I'm having a problem with something, or just if I want to think it through, and then talk to myself or like text myself. And I find that really helpful. So I am constantly taking notes while I'm writing, thinking about where something could go, or like a line of dialogue, or what someone's motivation is. So it feels like a subconscious process a lot of the time as well. And I probably spend a bit too much time planning or thinking through what's going to happen. And then once I get to the page, I'm like, oh yeah, I should have just been here a bit earlier almost to get it down. Because I do, with Disturbance, I did go back and plan it. But ultimately some of the things that happened in it, I couldn't have figured out until I was actually writing it, because the characters do something that surprise you, or you think, actually, no, that, you know, that's not their motivation, this is their motivation. So a lot of it comes through the like redrafting, editing stuff as well.
I'm really glad you said that thing about the 3 hours, because that's exactly my experience. And I mean, I don't think my brain would be able to engage with writing from 9 to 5. I just really don't think it would work like that for me. So it's nice to hear other people say that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I just, I think it might, maybe it comes for me from doing poetry as well, but like, you can get a draft of a poem down in 20 minutes, and then you can like leave your desk and you're like, haha, I've done like a good day's work there. But with a novel, it's so much slower. So I think it's about making it feel faster in a way, and like engineering it so it feels like you get a good little like dopamine hit. And then you leave it at that point.
And did you find, because you're a poet, that you were agonizing over, you know, every line, every word? Or did you think, because you were working on the novel, did you think, oh, I've got a bit more, I don't need to worry about this as much? Or, I mean, I don't know, maybe because you're a poet, you were thinking about every sentence as you were writing it.
Yeah, I was thinking about every sentence as I wrote it, but I think that sort of worked against me, because poetry is really elliptical. So I would write these scenes, but they'd be far too short. So then I'd have to go back in and sort of pull them out. And in poetry, you're trying to like be as economical as possible. Whereas I realized that in a novel, you don't want to be as economical as possible necessarily, because you're shutting your reader out from all the things that make the world and the characters rich. So I did agonize over every line and every bit of dialogue and every image. But I really enjoyed that, actually. Like, that's where I feel comfortable doing that. So that was the pleasure of the writing, definitely.
And what is it, what is the aspect of writing that you find the hardest? Sounds like, I mean, your approach is kind of chaotic, but it seems to work for you. So what's the thing that you know, if you could take a magic pill and it would fix one aspect of the writing process for you, what would be what would be the thing that you'd go, I need this?
I would definitely have a magic pill that solved all my plotting problems for me. That is, it's something that I don't think comes naturally to me, so I have to work really hard at. And I'm now a Save the Cat convert. I love that book. It has...
It is the best. I'm just going to say it's the best plotting book for me.
Yeah, yeah. It has changed my life. And if I'd have had that before I started writing Disturbance, I think I would have found it a lot more straightforward. I still think I like a bit of mystery as I come to writing something. But I definitely wish I was better. Or I wish, yes, since I've got that book, I feel better at plotting, but I definitely like see that as someone else making me better at plotting rather than it and being a natural gift I've been given. So yeah, if anyone has a magic pill that will do that for me, I'll happily take it.
And you probably covered this already with what we've spoken about before, but are there differences in what you, when it comes to kind of what you want to write about, do you think of them now as, this is a novel idea, this is a poetry idea? Is that kind of quite clearly defined in your head?
I think it is, yeah, because some, if I think of both things as telling a story, which in essence they do in my writing at least, I think the stories I want to write as novels just feel really sort of rich in a way that I couldn't make them in a poem. They need more people, they need longer, they need a whole world to be created. And the things I want to write about in poetry are probably sort of the smaller things, the more quotidian things, or the sort of thing that you will get some real pleasure out of writing in a really short, succinct way and focusing on images. So I think if I get an idea and I feel like that's image focused, then it goes into a poem. But if it sort of feels character driven and I think a good way of thinking about it is, if I keep on thinking about it and the world keeps on growing and growing and growing around it, then I think that's got to be a novel, or else I'm going to be doing it a disservice.
Mm. Can you tell us the story about how you came to get your agent and your book deal? I'm wondering whether you have the same agent for your poetry and your novel, or did that change? Like, what happened there?
Yeah, so I got my agent because I'd just published my first collection of poetry, and that had won an award. So I was in London for an award ceremony, because I don't live in London. The person who is now my agent sent me an email and said, are you around for a meeting? I'd like to meet you. So I met him, and I basically pitched him a novel that isn't Disturbance and I will probably never return to. But it was a project I was thinking about undertaking. So with that in mind, then he signed me for my second poetry collection when that was ready, and then took me on with the idea that I'd write this novel, or a novel, shortly after. So I started working with him mostly off the back of like the track record of my poetry, but with the idea that I'd always go into writing like non-fiction or fiction. And for me, I think I'll always write fiction rather than non-fiction. And then how I got my book deal is, I basically worked with my agent on Disturbance for about a year. So he was really helpful in sort of guiding what I was doing with it. And I really, like, it felt like a really isolating process writing this novel, especially because, yeah, it was during the pandemic, so I didn't have all my friends to talk to about it, or like all the usual ways you share your writing, or you think about your writing as you're doing it. So we were in conversation a lot about it. And that was really helpful for sort of workshopping my ideas and going away and doing something with them. And for me, I need some sense of accountability. I long thought that the reason I teach creative writing is that it's sort of part of my job to be a writer at the same time, so that makes me write. Whereas I think if I'd had a job that didn't sort of require some writing, I probably would have given it up years ago, or not given it up. I think it just would have never happened. So yeah, we were working on the novel together, and then sent it out for submission, and then it went to auction with 4 publishers, I think, and then yeah, we went with Trapeze, who have been really great.
Brilliant. I want to ask you actually about your experience with the publishing industry, and how it's been like for you, really, whether there's been anything that's been surprising or difficult to deal with, and what advice you'd have for anyone, well, for the next cohort, let's say, of debut novelists that will be publishing in 2024, what would be your advice on how to kind of cope with all the ups and downs of the publishing experience?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I've had a really great team at Trapeze, which just really, really helps. And I think that's one of the things that made me decide to go with them, is that I thought they'd be really supportive, and they had a good idea of what they wanted to do with the novel. But I'd say, like, my one piece of advice is that when I sold the novel, I sort of thought of publication day as the sort of big event in the calendar. But what you realize as you go through the process of, like, getting your blurbs, getting your cover, like, doing all the copy editing and the proofreading, there's like so many joyful moments in the lead up to that, that publication day can be a bit flat almost, or a bit like, okay. So I try and think of this as like a long game. Publication day isn't like the end of your novel, it's actually only the beginning. And so, you know, put a lot of work into getting your book out there, like shout about your book, let people know about it. But don't be worried if on publication day it's like not the first book everyone's talking about or something. Like, your book has time to make its impact, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say do something for you on that day, be it, I don't know, go to your favorite forest or go for a meal or whatever it is that you enjoy doing to kind of give yourself a treat as well. Because it's like, it's a hard year, well, hard 18 months, plus the fact that you've probably been writing the book for much longer than that. So I think do something that's nice for you. So finally, Jenna, can you tell us a little tease about what you're working on next?
Yes. So I am slowly, tentatively working on a second novel. I think it's going to be about a cult. And that's probably all I'll say about it, because I'm worried that I will change my mind a lot. hopefully more spooky, scary, unsettling vibes coming.
I'm a big fan. I love anything to do with cults, so sign me up. I really look forward to it. Jenna, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chloe. It's been really fun.
That was Jenna Clegg, talking about her literary novel, Disturbance, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.